writer's voice. To celebrate our 30 years of on-air service, Virginia Voice's Patty Campbell talks to noted writers about their lives and work.
I'm your host, Patty Campbell, and today I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Harry Lee Poe, Hal Poe, who is the author of Edgar Allan Poe, a biography. Welcome, Hal.
Thank you, Patty. It's good to be here.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here, and I think we feel very privileged that you are here because, in fact, you don't make your home in Richmond.
No, I live in Jackson, Tennessee.
Where you are a professor?
Yes, the Charles Colson Professor of Faith and Culture at Union University.
But you're here in Richmond in connection with your role as the president of the board at the Poe Museum.
Yes.
Great. Edgar Allan Poe, Hal Poe, can't help but notice the similarity in names.
They
there.
Rhyme.
Are you related?
He was my great-great-grandfather's cousin.
What made you decide to write this book?
I wrote it as an invitation from Barnes & Noble, who wanted a book on Poe for the bicentennial. And I had been working on Poe for quite a while with my own private collection of Poe, preparing an exhibition that has traveled through several states in the South and will soon be going to St. Petersburg, Russia. Because I'd been doing that, I had the narrative in place. I'd done all the research. And when Barnes & Noble issued the invitation, I was happy to do it and realized I would have no other occasion like this to be able to do something like that. So it was fun to do.
Well, we're dying to hear something from it. Will you read something?
I will. And let me say just a bit. Most people have a popular mythology of Poe that he was obsessed with death. And that's not quite true. He was actually obsessed with beauty and love. The anthologists that put together high school literature books usually pick out one or two of the gloomiest of his stories that he wrote primarily because they were popular kinds of literature in the 19th century. People just couldn't get enough blood and gore. But he didn't like those kinds of stories. What he was really interested in was deeper themes and broader themes, and he liked to write other kinds of stories. But let me read just a snippet here about the first book he wrote, which was Tamerlane, a collection of poems. Tamerlane deals with four themes that would continue to occupy Poe throughout his life: beauty, love, pride, and death. The poem tells the story of a Mongol peasant who rose to power in his tribe and eventually conquered most of Central and South Asia. When he returned in glory to marry his childhood sweetheart, he found that she had died. Tamerlane had made a fool's bargain. What is unusual about Poe at this early stage is his mature examination of human frailty, mortality, and what matters most in life. Tamerlane is like Ebenezer Scrooge, without his three ghosts to shake him free of himself before it's too late. Unlike his character Tamerlane, Poe would never trade love for pride and ambition. He had seen what such a bargain had done for John Allan. Allan was his foster father. Tamerlane expresses a profound sense of justice that would permeate the poetry, fiction, and essays of Poe as he developed as a writer, and made possible the mystery stories and literary criticisms for which Poe would become famous.
Your mention of Mr. Allan, I think that most of us carry around in our mind the knowledge that Poe and Allan did not get along together well. But I actually did not know the story of why until I read this book.
Yes, Poe's parents died by the time he was 2 years old. He was orphaned here in Richmond. His parents were actors, which was a disreputable occupation in the early 19th century. His grandfather, General David Poe, had been impoverished by the Revolution, so he was only able to take one of the children. Poe had a brother and a sister. Two families in Richmond took Poe and his younger sister, Rosalie. The McKenzie family took Rosalie, and the Allen family took Edgar. He had a happy childhood. There was nothing morose about it or sad. He was loved, and he loved his family. What he didn't know was that Mr. Allen had not just a double life, but a triple life. He had several extra families with several illegitimate children. To his credit, he did provide for those children and left a bequest to them in his will. But while he was living, it was his deep secret, and he didn't want anyone to know. When Mrs. Allen found out about it, and Edgar, they were horrified. And that was the beginning of the estrangement between Poe and Allen.
Well, read some more from your wonderful book.
All right. Well, when he left the University of Virginia, he entered the Army under an assumed name because he was not an officer. And from his background, having been raised to be a gentleman, it was not appropriate for a gentleman to be an enlisted man in the Army. The only way to be an officer was to go to West Point. So he took an assumed name, Edgar Perry. From May until November 8, 1827, Poe served at Fort Independence in Boston Harbor. Then his company sailed for Charleston, South Carolina, where he would serve at Fort Moultrie on Sullivan's Island. This period of remarkable peace was the ideal time for a man of letters to be a soldier. Military duties, which included drill and artillery exercise, took only a few hours a day. Poe avoided the more laborious duties an enlisted man might perform because of the skill he demonstrated as a clerk. Poe had time to read and to write. He most likely wrote his second longest poem, Al-Araf, during his stay on Sullivan's Island. Poe also had time to explore the island with its remarkable semi-tropical vegetation and wildlife of land, sea, and air. In those days, before the jetties were constructed offshore to protect Charleston Harbor, the beach at Sullivan's Island was covered with a lush variety of seashells. For a literary man, Poe had a lifelong fascination with all the sciences, from astronomy to botany to biology to what would become known as psychology. He had a curiosity about nature that seemed drawn by its beauty. This fascination eventually resulted in what he considered his most important work, Eureka, written the year before he died.
And are you going to tell us more about Eureka?
Eureka was a part of a lifelong quest for Poe. Eureka is the Greek word that means I have found it. He was struggling with a problem that a lot of people have, a philosophical problem called the problem of evil. If there's a good, all-powerful God, then why did my mother die? Hmm. Why do bad things happen to good people? Why doesn't God just make everything happy and pleasant? So it was a big problem for Poe. But at the same time, he noticed there were other problems equally large. If there's just a physical universe, just brute matter, then why do we have such things as beauty? And he was profoundly aware of that. And how can you even talk about bad things happening? In just a materialistic universe, things happened, neither good nor bad. It just stuff happens. And then the problem of justice. Why do you even think that something is wrong or something is right when it happens to you? In a materialistic universe, things just happen. So these were big questions he had, and while he loved literature, he also loved science. And his next book of poems has as its title poem an Islamic word, an Arabic word, Al-Araf, and it refers to a star, probably a supernova, that occurred at the end of the medieval period, beginning of the modern period. So let's read a bit about it. In spite of the earlier appearance of Tamerlane, Poe considered the 1829 book his first. He featured his most recent poem in the title, Al-Araf, Tamerlane, and Minor Poems. Poe had given a brief description of his new poem in a letter to Isaac Lee when he originally submitted the manuscript for consideration. Poe wrote, "Its title is Al-Araif, from the Al-Araif of the Arabians, a medium between heaven and hell where men suffer no punishment, but yet do not attain that tranquil and even happiness which they suppose to be the characteristics of heavenly enjoyment. I have placed this Al-Araif in the celebrated star discovered by Tycho Brahe, which appeared and disappeared so suddenly. It is represented as a messenger star of the deity, and at the time of its discovery by Tycho, as on an embassy to our world. One of the peculiarities of Al-Araif is that, even after death, those who make choice of the star as their residence do not enjoy immortality, but, after a second life of high excitement, sink into forgetfulness and death." This idea is from Job, quote, "I would not live always, let me alone," end quote. I have imagined that some would not be pleased with an immortality, even of bliss. In Al-Araif, Poe speaks of Ligeia and Zante, names he would use again in a short story and a poem. He addresses the nature of beauty and the ultimate end of life, taking inspiration from a scientific phenomenon that occurred at the end of the medieval period and the beginning of the modern period. Poe was fascinated by astronomy as science and the heavens as beauty. He was at once rationalist and romantic. The intersection of science and imagination would play an increasingly important role in the development of his poetry, fiction, and his understanding of the universe and of life itself.
A whole new look at Poe. If somebody wanted a copy of this, we've been talking about Barnes & Noble. Is it only available at Barnes & Noble?
Yes, Barnes & Noble produced it, and it's only available through Barnes & Noble.
Either in the stores or online?
Or online, yes.
Okay. You won an Edgar for this
book. I won
an
Edgar Award. The Edgar Award is presented by the Mystery Writers of America, and it's a huge honor for me.
It's a huge honor for anyone to get an Edgar.
The Mystery Writers named their award in honor of Edgar Allan Poe because he, in fact, created the mystery story. He wrote the first mystery story that was ever written. He wrote five mystery stories with five different kinds of plots. And the mystery writer and scholar Dorothy L. Sayers, in an essay on the mystery, said that Poe essentially created all of the basic plots of a mystery, and the rest are just imitations. You change the location, and once he'd exhausted that, he didn't write any more mystery stories.
Well, I've gotten you off reading, and we want to hear more.
Well, let's read a little bit about the mystery then. Poe began his tenure with Graham's Magazine in spring 1841 by publishing a story called The Murders in the Rue Morgue, what critics have long called the first mystery story ever written. It begins with the kind of horror one expects to find at the conclusion of a story. Two women are found murdered in an upper story room that is locked from the inside. The bodies of the victims had been horribly mutilated, and the room is stained with blood. Instead of making the horror the center of attention, Poe shifted the focus to a question of how and why the atrocity had occurred. Poe set the story in Paris, where C. Auguste Dupin, an impoverished aristocrat, used his acute intellect to solve the crime. The narrator and Dupin share a house, and this relationship of the detective and his loyal friend would become a fixture in the formula of detective fiction. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle created Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson. Dorothy L. Sayers had her Lord Peter Wimsey and his faithful man Bunter. Agatha Christie had her Hercule Poirot and his friend Captain Hastings. The formula continues into modern movies and television dramas. When the police arrive on the crime scene in The Murders in the Rue Morgue, they arrest the wrong man, rooting the mystery story in the pursuit of truth as the agent of justice. the failure of the police and the effort to free the person wrongly accused would become another fixture of detective fiction. To succeed, the detective story needs an ingenious solution that the reader does not anticipate, but which brings delight when explained. The skillful writer provides all the information, but genius lies in the interpretation of the data. In the narrator's introduction to the story, Poe reveals his own growing understanding of the relationship between analytical thought and fancy, or between science and imagination. He said, quote, "The analytic power should not be confounded with simple ingenuity, for while the analyst is necessarily ingenious, the ingenious man is often remarkably incapable of analysis. The constructive or combining power by which ingenuity is usually manifested, and to which the phrenologist, I believe erroneously, have assigned a separate organ, supposing it a primitive faculty, has been so frequently seen in those whose intellect bordered otherwise upon idiocy as to have attracted general observation among writers on morals. Between ingenuity and the analytic ability, there exists a difference far greater, indeed, than that between the fancy and the imagination, but of a character very strictly analogous. It will be found, in fact, that the ingenious are always fanciful, and the truly imaginative never otherwise than analytic." Now, Poe at this point rejects the choice between the rational and the intuitive, insisting instead upon a union of the two. Thus, he does not fit easily into the categories of enlightenment or romantic writing.
Interesting to listen to that and think about the points that you have made about Poe so far. The poet, the romantic poet, the man who is interested in science. We know also that he was a critic. All of those things seem to come through in that selection that you read. And that was from The Murders in the Rue Morgue, wasn't it?
Yes, this is his introduction in which he really discusses imagination. And imagination isn't just a sort of a sideline to throw out, daydreaming, that sort of thing. He says it's really the reason that a scientist is able to come up with a new idea. It's the source of new knowledge, seeing what has never been seen before. He says it's neglected, but the people who make the great discoveries are the ones who have imagination.
We don't really think of Poe as being a man of science or a science writer. Did he do much writing about science?
Well, the French credit him with inventing not just the mystery story, but also science fiction. Jules Verne copied several of his stories. In fact, when Jules Verne wrote his first science fiction story, 5 Weeks in a Balloon, he was copying Poe's story, The Balloon Hoax. Later on, he would imitate several of Poe's stories. Let's read just a little bit about one of Poe's science fiction ventures. In spite of all the work he did for Graham, Poe also managed to sell a few pieces to other editors, including Eleonora, which appeared in The Gift of 1842, and A Succession of Sundays, now known as Three Sundays in a Week, with the Saturday Evening Post of November 27, 1841. In the latter story, the heroine was 15 and her cousin past 20, and they wanted to marry. The hero's great uncle would not permit it until three Sundays came together in a week. On Sunday, October 10, the two cousins visit their great uncle when two sea captains also called on him after year-long voyages in which they circled the globe in opposite directions. One captain insisted that the previous day was Sunday, while the other captain insisted that the next day would be Sunday. this humorous tale of the relativity of time and space would be taken up a few years later by Jules Verne in Around the World in 80 Days. It would be taken up 60 years later by a Swiss patent office clerk named Albert Einstein in his theory of general relativity.
I was thinking, it's amazing.
Yes, he really does anticipate the theory of relativity in several of his tales and talks about the relativity of time and space.
Do we know whether Einstein ever read Poe?
We do. We know that he read Poe's great work, Eureka. He had a copy of it in his personal library. It might be appropriate for us then to see what Poe actually did in that tale. Well, it's not a tale, really. It's an extended essay on the nature of the universe. On February 3rd, 1848, Poe gave a public lecture at the Society Library in New York, where he read from Eureka, the work he considered his greatest achievement. George Putnam, who had published several of Poe's earlier books, published Eureka in July 1848 with a print run of 500 copies and a $14 advance to Poe. Poe had asked for an initial run of 50,000, but a $14 advance helped to ease some of his disappointment. In Eureka, a synthesis of empirical observation and rational analysis, Poe proposed what science now calls the Big Bang Theory. By a series of logical steps that proceed from the observation of the distribution of the stars in the sky and the action of gravity, Poe argues that the universe came from one primordial particle that God willed into being. He anticipated Einstein by arguing that space and duration are one, and stresses that with light, there is a continuous outpouring of ray streams, and with a force which we have at least no right to suppose varies at all. This idea of the speed of light as being the one constant in the universe. Poe's 19th century audience would have thought him crazy for postulating a finite universe that began from a primordial particle. In the conclusion of Eureka, Poe drew another startling conclusion, that in creating the primordial particle and dividing it throughout what became the universe, God dispersed himself throughout the whole, and that what we call his creatures are actually infinite individualizations of himself. That is, he was conceiving, what does it mean to be made in the image of God? So Poe is actually drawing in the 19th century an understanding of the relationship and the continuity between science and faith. But when he did it, they thought he was a madman, because in the 19th century, the universe was still locked into Aristotle's 2,500-year-old Greek view that the universe has always existed and that there's an infinite number of stars. And so all of the biographies of Poe, written well into the latter half of the 20th century, talk about his disturbed mind for thinking that the universe began from a tiny speck.
From a big bang.
From a big bang, which is now the accepted
science
theory of the day.
Right. Mm-hmm. Do people read Eureka today?
Very few people read Eureka. It wasn't in print. It wasn't included in most of the collections of Poe's works, simply because it just didn't make sense to people. And literary people who read it didn't have the scientific background to understand it, while the scientific people tended not to read some obscure essay by a French major. But there was one man who did read it. He was a Belgian priest named Lemaître, and he was a Poe scholar, but he was also a physicist, and he is the one who actually formalized the Big Bang Theory in the early 20th century.
Wow, That's very, very impressive. Did you have an idea of these things before you started your research, or did you, as you worked on this book, discover?
Well, I didn't know about this, about the Eureka Big Bang argument, simply because no one ever talked about it. I had a course on Poe in college, but no discussion of this at all. But I'm not a literary man by profession. I'm a theologian, and one of my areas is science and religion. And so when I did become president of the Poe Museum and started poking around and found Eureka, I was amazed, because Poe was anticipating 20th century science in 1848. And the discussions he had then are only now beginning to take place again in the science and religion communities. So it was amazing to me what I was discovering. And so in the last 10 years, a number of physicists have rediscovered Poe and have been fascinated by the theological implications of what Poe talks about.
We have time for just a little bit more. Could you read one more thing for
us? Yes, let's read about his last summer, when he came back to Richmond, a town where he was always happiest. Soon after arriving in Richmond, Poe made an important call. One Sunday morning, he went to see Elmira Royster Shelton, his childhood sweetheart, and the subject of his long poem, Tamerlane. Left a young widow when her elderly husband died, Elmira was still beautiful in her late 30s. She was on her way to church, but told Poe that he might call again later. When he returned, he immediately made known that he still loved her. They spent time together throughout the summer and into September. She heard him deliver his first lecture in Richmond, which she thought very beautiful. She wrote to Mrs. Clem, this was Poe's aunt and mother-in-law, on September 22nd, to assure her that she was prepared to love her and to let her know that Edgar was, quote, sober, temperate, moral, and much beloved, end quote. Elmira admitted that she had never gotten over her youthful love. She wrote, I remember seeing Edgar and his lovely wife very soon after they were married. I met them. I shall never forget my feelings at the time. They were indescribable, almost agonizing. However, in an instant, I remembered that I was a married woman and banished them from me as I would a poisonous reptile. In 1849, however, Elmira was no longer a married woman. When Mr. Shelton died, he left his young widow a wealthy woman in a town that appreciated wealth. Though when they were married, Shelton certainly didn't have the prospects of an Allen heir, he did quite well. His will provided, however, that if she remarried, Elmira would cease to benefit from his generosity. Marriage to Edgar Poe would be expensive. In the end, love prevailed, and Elmira agreed to marry her first love. Poe, who desperately desired wealth again and the financial security that could support his magazine, also chose to marry for love. He still expected to make his fortune on his own.
Romance. Edgar Allan Poe. Hal, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's been a pleasure to be with you.
We've been talking to Dr. Harry Lee Poe, Hal Poe, who is the president of our own Poe Museum here in Richmond, Virginia, and the Edgar-winning author of Edgar Allan Poe, An Illustrated Companion to His Telltale Stories, available at Barnes & Noble. I'm Patty Campbell for the Virginia Voice.
You've been listening to The Writer's Voice. Listen online or download to your computer or MP3 player at www.virginiavoice.org. Virginia Voice. Connect by listening.